So we're moving on to agenda paper 6. My handing over to you, Filippo.
Yes, thank you, Sue, and good morning, everybody. So in January, board received an update on the research project and asked the staff to develop examples to illustrate how the capped approach would apply and how the outcome would compare with existing requirements in IS 19. The objective of this session is to present and discuss the illustrative example. We're not asking the board for any decision, but we have a number of questions for you at the end of the paper. As a reminder, under the capped approach, the entity would cap the projection of the benefits to vary with asset returns at the discount rate specified in IS 19 instead of using the expected returns on the reference assets. The main terms of the benefit and example are explained in paragraph 19 of the paper. And just for a clear understanding of the results, I will point out some of those assumptions. In the example, the entity is not applying the straight line adjustment that is required under IS 19 when the plan formula allocates a substantially higher benefit to later years of service. The entity is funding the plan and is investing in the reference assets, and the benefits are immediately paid as a lump sum at the end of the service period. In the appendix, we show how changing of each of these assumptions would affect the calculations. Moreover, in the example, we assume that there are no vesting conditions to be considered when determining the defined benefit obligation, and future returns are expected to exceed the minimum guarantee in the plan. So based on these terms and assumptions, tables 3 and 6 in the paper show respectively how the defined benefit obligation would be determined by the entity over the period, respectively under IS 19 and under the capped approach. And table 5 and 7 show how the net pension liability would be measured and change over the period under IS 19 and under the capped approach. And of course, if you look at that, the main difference is how the service cost is calculated. For year one, for instance, under IS 19, the entity would take the contribution under the plan formula for the first year. It would project using the expected returns on the asset, which is 4% for each year to the end of the service period. And then it would discount it back at the reporting date using a discount rate that is set at 2.31%. And that results in a service cost of 6,729. Under the capped approach, projection would be made by using the discount rate. So it would use 2.31% to project, and then it would use the same discount rate to discount it back. And of course, that would result in the same service cost. As a consequence of the capping, in later year, the entity would have to adjust the final benefit obligation to account for the difference between the actual return on the assets and the discount rate originally used. And that would mean that would originate what we have called the true-up adjustment. You can see in Table 6 in the paper. And in the paper, we have included some initial thought from the staff about the presentation of this true-up adjustment. And with that, I think it's enough to start the discussion. As I said, we welcome all questions and comment on the examples, but our questions in particular are on page 19. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody, questions, comments? Mary.
Thanks. Filippo, let me start by thanking the staff for what I think is a really, really good paper. This is a really challenging issue. I was going to call it ugly, but I think I'll just call it challenging issue to think about. And we need examples, I think, to make it come alive. And you've done a great job at doing that, controlling for certain things to avoid complexity, but so that in a way that brings out what the impacts will be. And I have to say, for it's the first time I've really gotten, I think, comfortable with the approach that the staff has been encouraging us to consider. I did have a few comments. They aren't related maybe directly to the questions that the board has asked. One is the phrasing of the scope of the project. If I look at paragraph 12 in your paper, it says, in some pension plans, some or all benefits paid to employees vary with the return on a specified pool of assets. And I think we have in mind maybe a narrower subset of that description than some, not would think, but some may want to interpret. And what I mean by that is, some might want to argue that as long as you have a ring fence pension plan, let's say with separate trustees, that as long as the employer has paid the current period contribution requirements, that all participants in the plan are to some extent exposed to the sufficiency of assets in terms of realization of benefits. And I think we are talking about a much narrower set of plans in which the benefits paid to employees vary directly with the return on a specified pool of assets. And that's what you have illustrated in all these examples. So I'd like to ask you to think about using a word like directly in terms of the description of the project. And then we can also comment about how the kind of ring fencing doesn't bring basically every separately funded plan into the scope of this project. So that's something I think is really important to me in terms of this approach being applied to the circumstances for which we intended it. In terms of the other issues that you tee up here, I agree with you that addressing the accounting for the guarantee is broader than this project and should be outside the scope of the project. I am actually not enthusiastic about us doing anything about it, because, at least in advance of our agenda consultation, because IS-19 is getting harder and harder to maintain. And so I think we have to understand what our long-term plan is for IS-19 before we think about investing in additional issues. And that's reflected in the very tight, either we can do this or we stop doing this project definition of this research project. So what you said in paragraph 66, I agree with. And the last thing in terms of initial views on the presentation of the true-up adjustment, I guess it would be helpful to me if you could maybe bring out a bit more the costs of separation of this piece, because to me, as I look through the arguments in paragraph 58 to 63, the difficulty and cost of separating out the amount that should be considered true up is one of the things that maybe made me lean to OCI, because that's where the rest of it would be recognized. But I am loath to increase the use of OCI, so I want to make sure that I have a really good understanding of how substantive that difficulty is. So that in terms of further information, that's my request on that one. Those are my points. Thanks very much. Really good job.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. Thank you, Philippe, the staff making the examples, because it just makes the very complex issue easier to understand. But I still have some questions here. First is actually related to one comment that Mary said. Why I'm just having this specific group of assets if it's not just related to the return of the assets? For example, could be the entire portfolio of the assets, for example. I'm just struggling to understand why a specific group of assets. And the second point is related to the true up, is more a clarification. I understand that in the end of the day, when we compare before and after the capping mechanism, what we are changing actually is the service cost, and as a consequence, the interest expense. And if we don't have any remeasurement, because we did both without and with remeasurement, if you don't have remeasurement, in the end of the day, it's just a timing difference that we have in P&L, isn't it? But I still need to do the true up if I go for the capping mechanism. If I am right, I think that true up would make more sense to be recognized in P&L. It doesn't make sense to be OCI. That's slightly different if I go for, again, if I understood correctly, for a situation of remeasurement. And then in this case, I have an actuarial gain and loss that part of it could be related to the interest rate difference, and part of this is related to the change in assumption. The change in assumption makes sense as an actuarial gain loss to OCI, but just a difference in interest rate asset liability, I think that should P&L. But if you just could clarify if I made any comment that doesn't make sense, just look at the example, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Filippo, do you want to respond?
Yes, very quickly. I think that Theo's point is correct in the sense that if you look at the definition in IAS 19 of what component of expense are included in OCI, it is difficult to fit the true-up adjustment into that because it is not the effect of a remeasurement, it is not an effect of a change in the assumptions, it's just a mechanical effect of the fact of cap in the calculation. And so in a way, you could see it as a complement to the service cost originally recognized. It also does not fit in the definition of prior service cost because it's not an effect of a change in the plan. So it's true that based on how we defined the measurement in IAS 19, it's a little bit difficult to fit it in OCI. On the other side, I mean, we are a little bit aware that in a real life calculation that is much more complex than what we have in the example, it may be difficult to isolate the specific effects. And so, I mean, at this stage, I mean, we're really thinking within the team, we're just thinking of the different arguments, but we don't have a recommendation.
Thank you.
Peter, did you want to add something?
Yes, please. I'd like to comment on something that's one of the things I had learnt since the board originally put this project on the agenda. And we've learnt it really from the very good work Filippo's done here, and actually some earlier work when he did when he was still at FRAG on the same topic. So to take you back to the beginning, the reason we set up the project this way is because theoretically we could deal with the problem we're trying to fix either by adjusting the discount rate or by adjusting the cash flows. For various reasons, it's proved to be too difficult to do it through the discount rate. So now we're exploring doing it through the cash flows. When we first suggested that approach to you, we were focusing very much on the measurement. We weren't really thinking about what the consequences might be for the display of the performance information. And so if you think about what would have happened if we had adjusted through the discount rate rather than through the cash flows, you would have unwinding of the discount over time that will get reported in a particular way, probably in net interest, although it's a different discount rate we're talking about. Now, one of the interesting things I think that Filippo's research has shown is that in this approach where we're adjusting through the cash flows, that link kind of breaks down in a way. And that's why Filippo was saying earlier that if you look at the sort of catalogue of different categories of performance information in IAS 19, it doesn't cover this one. And so to some extent, it's a kind of artifact of the fact that we're adjusting through the cash flows rather than through the discount rates. And that's the thing to bear in mind, I think, when you think about where best to present it, whether it fits best in P&L or best in OCI. And there are arguments on both sides. I'm not going to try and sort of push one or the other at the moment. But that's a piece of the context, I think, to bear in mind, that this is a measurement technique that gets the same measurement, but then it ends up possibly having different consequences for how you disaggregate the performance information.
Thank you, Peter. Rika.
Thank you, Sue. I think the CAP approach on this paper can fix the application issue of inconsistency in measuring DBO in IS-19 in terms of this specific pension plan on this paper. And I believe that this is the only way to fix this issue. But at the same time, this approach will introduce an exception to the IS-19's requirements about the DBO determination, and implementation of this idea is not consistent with the requirement of paragraph 57AI. So while this approach has been, maybe not this approach, maybe similar approach has been already seen in the practice, we need to be careful to consider whether this exception incurs any unintended consequences, which might adversely affect the practice outside of this plan. So in order to proceed this project further, I would like to understand a little bit about the 3 points. One point is why the condition excludes a case that the plan possibly becomes a deficit, or case the actual return is above the guaranteed minimum return in some period and below in other period. I would like to see the case to make sure what would happen in the case that the actual return volatiles below or above the guaranteed minimum return across periods, so which might not be consistent with what Mary said. And the second point is because of the calculation mechanism of DBO determination and probably the net interest approach in IS-19 is kind of the using the, so maybe fixing this issue using a discount rate as a cap rate is the best approach to solve the issue, but it will be helpful to give more acute articulation about why discount rate should be a cap rate in this approach. And the last one is maybe it's very close to what Tadu said. The origin of a true-up adjustment is making an exception in DBO determination to replace the expected rate of return with a cap rate. But as an outcome of this cap approach, the nature of a true-up adjustment can be more complicated than original. So some portion is incurred by unwinding the discount at the rate, and the other portion can be caused by the reflection of the measurement of plan asset. So it will be very helpful if the staff can further explore the nature of this true-up adjustment in order to decide what the presentation will be the best. Thank you.
Thanks, Rika. Mary, did you want to comment on Rika's point?
I wanted to comment just on one thing. Rika, when I said I did not want to pursue standard setting regarding the minimum return guarantee, I was talking about pursuing that globally in terms of saying, here's how you should account for such a guarantee for any plan under IS-19. I don't have any concerns about what you suggested, which is looking at what happens if the actual returns go below the minimum return guaranteed in an arrangement like this.
Then I agree with your view. Thank you, Mary, for clarification.
Thanks, Rika. Jing Chao?
Thank you, Sue. First of all, I also appreciate the staff paper. It was very good paper to illustrate how the proposed captured approach will work. I think the issue mainly came from the differences between the expected return on plan assets and the discount rate. So when I look at the example, it illustrates if if the difference is very big, so it's caused a lot of, you know, accounting issues. If it's narrow, the issues will be narrow. So it's reminded me, I think in the past I heard some from stakeholders, because the expected return on plan assets in some jurisdictions, some companies, it's based on the, you know, future expectation judgment. And when they determine the discount rate, according to our accounting standard, it should be based on the high quality bond, you know, rate. But sometimes what kind of bond you needed to find, and in some jurisdiction maybe sometimes difficult to find high quality bond, something like that. So in order to minimize the differences, some companies try to make both, you know, judgment as close as possible. So I think in the future when we say, I think we should also illustrate that how the company needed to determine the expected return and make it clear how to determine the discount rate. And then it will, I think it will help for to add more discipline when we use the example. I think the example is very good. And the second is about how to present the true-up, you know, adjustment, and whether it should be presented in the P&L and the OCI. Because currently, the deficit or excess returns should be presented in OCI. From my point of view, the nature, as staff have said, that the nature is similar. So if, because the deficit or excessive return should be presented in OCI, so I think a true-up adjustment is better to be presented in OCI as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Jing Chao. I don't see any other people with their hands up or in the chat box. So I think you gave us such a good analysis in the paper, Filippo, that you have a better time at the board table. So with that, can you hear me?
Not very well. You were asking what are the next steps?
I think we're done for now, unless you need something more from us, Filippo, for this paper.
No, it's okay. But if any board member has additional comments or questions, they can just get in touch with the team.
Yes, that sounds good. All right. Now, I propose we stop now and have a break. We're slightly ahead of schedule, which is good because that gives us a bit more time in terms of allowing us more time to catch up on PFS papers this afternoon. So I propose that we break for 30 minutes now. And so we reconvene at about 12:05 UK time. So I'll see you all then. Thank you.